Words appear. The following is based on true events. The American flag waves atop the Supreme Commander's headquarters. A khaki-clad aide shows Webb inside MacArthur's office, where an officer with center-parted hair waits.
President Webb, Justice Kramer, Judge Advocate General and our man to replace Higgins.
Justice Kramer.
And Justice Webb.
I read your dossier. You studied at Harvard.
Yes, I did. Did you?
No. Queensland.
As Justice Kramer nods, MacArthur shifts on his feet.
Sir William has a very tough job of it, but I assure you he has both hands on the reins.
The justices face each other. In a screening room, a film projector starts. NHK, Japan Broadcasting Corporation, presents in association with Netflix and the support of the Netherlands Film Fund and the Netherlands Film Production Incentive. A NHK Japan Broadcasting Corporation, Fat Productions, and Don Carmody Television DCTV production. A newsreel shows citizens waving Japanese flags as a military procession passes. Tim Ahern, Paul Freeman, ordnance strafes the countryside, then a fighter plane crashes. Serge Hazanavicius, corpses litter the ground. Marcel Hensema, William Hope, Jonathan Hyde, a squadron drops torpedo bombs. A mushroom cloud appears. Michael Ironside, Irfan Khan. On a warship, a Japanese dignitary signs a document. Stephen McHattie, David Say, Shinya Tsukamoto, Julian Wadham. Bert Matthias, Hadwi Shminis, Gabiha Haraminayate, Horgi Franson, Kistudis Yakstas. Justices preside over a courtroom, casting Kelly Valentine Hendry and Victor Jenkins. Production design consultant Naoji Kawaguchi, costumes by Brenda Schenner. Production designer Harry Amerlon, director of photography Rolf Deakins, NSC, edited by Daryl Davis, CCE, music by Robert Carley. Co-producers Takafumi Yuki, Elwin Louie. Producers Shinsuke Naito, Hans De Weers, David Cormican. Executive producers Takashi Enjo, Shinsuke Naito, David Lee, Hans De Weers, Don Carmody, David Cormican. Words appear under Japanese characters. Tokyo Trial. Written by Keys Van Banyum, Rob King, Max Mannix, and Toru Takagi. With script contributions by Peter Verhoef. Directed by Rob King and Peter Verhoef.
July 1946. The prosecution's argument shifts its focus onto atrocities committed by the Japanese military on the Chinese mainland. December 1937. The ever-advancing Japanese military occupied Nanking. The prosecution begins examining witnesses and argues that many prisoners and non-combatants were killed at that time. For the first time, the judges will hear testimony from Chinese witnesses on this incident.
As his colleagues listen on headsets, May eyes an archival photo of a bespectacled man.
Witness Xu Chuan-Yin testifies about what he saw 3 days after the occupation of Nanking began.
The witness sits before microphones.
On Main Street, I even started trying to count the number of corpses lying on both sides of the street. And I started to count more than 500 myself. I say it was no use counting them.
Staffers sit with headsets.
In cross-examination, the defense tries to suggest that there might have been so-called plain-clothed troops who hid in private homes and staged surprise attacks on the Japanese.
Members of the gallery shift in their seats.
Xu Chuan-Yin answers with, "That might be. But still, you see, we consider them non-combatants before they gather themselves together again to engage in the hostile activities."
A second witness sports close-cropped hair.
On the same day, Shang Ti-Yi takes the witness stand. As he does not speak English, the prosecutor reads his previously recorded testimony.
A photo shows the witness gazing down.
"I was taken to the bank of the Yangtze River to find more than 1,000 male civilians there. At about 4 p.m., a Japanese officer came by and ordered the Japanese soldiers to start machine gunning us."
In another photo, he sits before a microphone.
"I slumped to the ground just before the firing started, and immediately I was covered with corpses and fainted. At about 9 p.m., I climbed out from the piles of corpses and ran to my house."
Webb presses his headset to his ear. As Rowling listens intently, Justice May cocks his head. Later, as the judges gather in chambers, May's bleary gaze fixes forward. Justice Webb's eyes dart furtively. Justice Patrick absently fingers his handkerchief. Beside him, Rowling eyes the table. Justice Bernard straightens.
Well, I cannot forgive such atrocities. However, I think we should adjudicate them as conventional war crimes. There is no need to categorize them as crimes against humanity, like the Nazis with the exterminations of the Jews.
Either way, the accused who are responsible cannot escape such terrible crimes.
Justice Bernard licks his lips.
Well,
let's just leave it there for today, shall we?
Justice Powell smooths his hair.
President Webb, if you please excuse me, I would rather we deliberate on the crimes of aggression. I must assert there's still a motion on the table to rule out waging of aggressive war as a crime.
I'm drafting a denial to the motion.
That is completely out of order.
You can't be serious.
I'm quite serious.
Zarayanov turns a cigarette lighter in his fingers as he stares purposefully at his Indian counterpart, then thumps the table.
It is absolutely clear from the testimony that the accused plotted to prepare and wage an aggressive war.
With respect to the general, the crimes of aggression did not exist at that time, nor did they exist at any time throughout the conflict in the Pacific.
Nuremberg did put the Nazis on trial for crimes of aggression.
That was, in my mind, also a questionable act.
These terrible things exceed by far anything in conventional jurisprudence. Are you really saying, after everything we've all seen today, that you think the Japanese leadership should be exempt?
No. I do not condone the atrocities. But I want to avoid applying a law that did not exist at the time these men took actions, and for which they now stand at trial.
No, no. This is senseless. We've all agreed. The charges stand as per the charter.
Agreed.
We also agreed that any dissenting opinion remain in the room.
We did not agree. I wasn't here when you decided.
Patrick rolls his eyes.
Gentlemen, our nerves are raw enough. Given the arduous testimony today, I'm adjourning any further discussion.
President Webb rises from his seat, followed by several other judges. McDougal retrieves his suit coat from a chair back. Rowling stares pensively, then sips from a glass of water. Justice Powell gathers his belongings on the table as he watches his colleagues head out. A man hobbles on crutches in a bombed-out section of the city. With a brilliant sun shining above, a black sedan passes citizens and servicemen in the rubble-strewn streets.
I read that almost 100,000 people were killed in one night in Tokyo.
Rowling and Patrick ride in the back seat.
Napalm bombs dropped by the Americans.
They glide past sailors who linger amidst the devastation.
You were a pilot in the First War?
Yes, fighter pilot. Not bombers.
What was it like?
Dirty, cold, and loud. The Germans shot my plane and legs full of holes. I was in a prisoner of war camp for the rest of the war.
Justice Patrick steadfastly avoids Rowling's gaze. A two-tiered pagoda stands in a park where the pair strolls along a footpath.
What do you make of Justice Powell? And what's your view of his argument to reject the charges of waging aggressive war?
For me, it's complicated.
How complicated can it be? Before we began, we all signed the charter.
Later, the justices convene in chambers.
Justice Haranelia wishes to start us off today.
Thank you. Before going any further, I wish to say to Justice Powell that though I respect your opinion concerning the charge of crimes against peace, which we are calling crimes of aggression, I find it rather improper. Many atrocities have been committed by the Japanese army during this war in places like China, Indonesia, Burma, and in my country, the Philippines. And these atrocities happened precisely because the Japanese leaders engaged in lawless acts of aggression. So I want to make it clear that I believe charges against all defendants are justified.
Pal paces, teacup in hand.
But Justice Pal, as I am writing our response concerning the defense motion to dismiss the charge of crimes of aggression, do you have anything more you wish to say?
Yes. I believe what the Japanese did throughout Asia was devilish and horrid. And they committed conventional war crimes. And the Japanese officers who committed these atrocities have been tried in local courts where they took place and have been given sentences. However, I implore each of you to consider more seriously my position that there is no legal ground for the charge of crimes of aggression.
Japan signed the Pact of Paris of 1928.
Pal takes a seat.
Now, it clearly states that all the signatories agreed to condemn war as a means of settling international disputes. They agreed to condemn war as an instrument of national policy.
But it does not provide legal ground for criminalizing war. And it doesn't suggest any penalties. And it certainly doesn't say anything about the responsibility of the officer or the politicians as an individual perpetrators. Given the way countries and societies continue to act against each other.
Pal lifts a book.
This Pact of Paris is an idealistic pledge.
Charging the accused for crimes of aggression is allowed in our charter.
The charter is wrong.
It was a precondition to our appointment on this tribunal.
We cannot and we should not debate whether the charter is right or wrong.
Я поддерживаю то, что сказал судья МакДугал.
Зараянов
points insistently. Это поддержать.
The general supports what Justice McDougall says, and you all should support that.
Yes, but not by making up laws at will.
Patrick frowns.
I agree, but why are we here, Justice Powell? We are here because we should be able to discuss what is the right step for humanity to take. And based on the outcome of that discussion, will make the best decisions for the law.
Respected gentlemen, I certainly believe law has the power to guide mankind. So its principles must be upheld.
Justice Pal scans the table.
That is why we must acquit all the defendants on the charge of crimes of aggression. For this is a law that does not truly exist yet.
Bernard throws up his hands.
If you cannot follow the Tokyo Charter, you should return to Calcutta.
I did not come from a country that struggles to gain its independence in order to have my arguments discarded or to be told to go home.
Patrick turns away and gazes up.
Let's adjourn it there for today.
Justice Pal reaches for his tea. Later, Justice Rowling puts on his gray suit coat. Straightening his cuffs, he eyes a book sitting atop the table. He fingers the cover of the Peace Pact of Paris, a study of the Brienne-Kellogg Treaty. Rowling eyes a message on the bookmark. Please read, our pal. McDougal, Northcroft, and Patrick sit at a hotel bar.
Paul is unbelievably stubborn.
Now, we can all agree about that. However, he's right when he argues that in domestic law, people can't be tried for actions that were not crimes at the time those actions were committed. But international law evolves under extreme circumstances.
If the Tokyo Tribunal does not strictly adhere to Nuremberg principles, it would mean passing judgment on the Nazis was a mistake. We cannot let that happen.
I agree.
McDougal shoots a look at the others. At night, Rowling heads down a hotel corridor. Nearby, Justice Pell retrieves a stack of books outside a room and waves to his colleague.
Someone on MacArthur's staff thought my skin color deserved a lesser hotel. But Webb fixed it.
That's good. It should have been like that from the beginning.
Why don't you join me for some tea?
Inside, Rowling picks up a framed photo.
Mahatma Gandhi.
By leading India toward independence in a unique way, he's an inspiration to the whole world.
What do you think? Will independence ever truly happen?
Oh, yes. By next year? Then the British can pack their suitcases.
Rowling returns Pal's smile. Then the men sip their tea.
Just what the doctor ordered.
The arguing is getting to you?
No. It's more the heat.
It's cooler outside. Why don't we take a walk in the garden?
That's a good idea.
Outside, they proceed along a walkway.
You gave Patrick quite a shock.
Yes. He must have thought, what is this silly Indian doing to suggest the accused be set free?
I know, that's what I was thinking.
Tell me, did you read the book I left for you on the Pact of Paris?
Yes. And I found it in many ways inspiring.
Good. But that deals with the past, not the present. Here in Tokyo, we are talking about the justice in the modern world. And yet a large part of Asia is still colonized by the West. These areas were conquered with violence. The indigenous people were exploited. Even our tea. The British take our best leaves from us, and we are left to drink with second grade or third grade tea.
But I don't see how that has anything to do with the court case.
The justices take a seat.
Inequality and racism still exists. Look at your own country, how it suppresses Indonesians in the so-called Dutch East Indies.
Well, we have tried to bring them prosperity. We prepared them for independence.
And just recently you have sent 100,000 soldiers there.
With all the chaos, we had no choice.
Rowling, your colonial spirit is alive and well.
Do you ever stop banging the same drum?
There again, you see, we bang drums while you send troops to fight so-called terrorists. In reality, they're freedom fighters who want to reclaim their country. So what gives the Dutch, the English, the French, the Americans the right to judge the Japanese for their claim that they wanted to free Asia?
It didn't sound like they were freeing the people of Nanking or the rest of Asia.
I like your fighting spirit, Rowling. It gives me a reason to keep drumming.
Justice Pell rocks gently back and forth in his seat. Back inside, the pair walk side by side past a lounge. At a table, Northcroft and Patrick gaze over warily. The New Zealander blows a puff of smoke, then removes his pipe from his mouth.
What do you think?
He sips his drink and eyes Patrick. The Scotsman grimaces. Later, in chambers, as the interpreter cools herself with a black fan, May fans himself with a sheaf of papers. Rowling, Northcroft, Pal, and the others peruse documents in front of them. President Webb stands at the head of the table and sets down his teacup.
Well, gentlemen, that's my argument for the existence of the charge of crimes of aggression. I believe it comprehensively refutes the defense motion and puts an end to our closed debate.
It does not change my opinion.
Well, there are some very, very interesting historical references. And
I don't want to sound rude, but the content seems written by first-year law students.
My assistants drafted it. Under my direction, of course. I believe it's erudite, concise, and effective.
On the contrary, it rambles when you quote Aristotle and the Dutch scholar Grotius. Why not also include Confucius?
Grotius is the father of international law, as relevant now as he was then.
You should have made clear that this court is completely in line with Nuremberg, short and simple.
Well, as I said, it's only a draft.
Then we'll wait for the next one.
Justice Patrick tosses it onto the table, followed by Justice Haranelia. Rowling draws on his cigarette. Outside, reporters await Webb.
Sir, you once said the trial would be over in 6 months. Can you tell us why you're so far behind schedule?
It's a lot of evidence to consider, sir.
I heard some judges aren't getting along.
We're all working together to get through this as quickly as we possibly can.
With a polite nod, President Webb dons his Homburg hat and heads downstairs. The newsmen stare after him, then swap a look. At night, a black sedan travels down an unpaved road. Inside a tastefully appointed home, a woman clad in a traditional robe leads Justice Rowling through an entryway to a large living area.
Please wait here.
Yes.
He sets down his violin case.
Okay.
He hands the servant his hat and coat, then bows.
Arigato.
The woman returns the gesture before stepping away. Rowling's attention falls on a white grand piano nearby. He turns to see Eta descending the stairs.
Herr Rowling.
Good evening.
I'm glad you accepted my invitation.
Well, I am very thrilled that we're going to play together.
Well, that remains to be seen. The list of violinists I would play with, in public or private, is very short. Oh, my lieber Gott, do you think me rude?
I think you're very German.
Good. You have a sense of humor. I wonder what else I might get to know about you.
She beckons him to sit.
Well,
he takes a seat across from his hostess.
Ask away.
Are you married?
Yes, and we have 5 children.
How impressive. And yet you leave them all behind to sit in that horrible courtroom and accomplish what?
Justice.
Justice.
They gaze thoughtfully for a long moment.
Let's see how well you play. If you can make my shortlist.
Rowling smiles and picks up his violin case. At the bar, Justice Haranelia approaches a table where Webb, McDougal, and Pal sit.
I'm bending over backwards to accommodate your opinion here.
That's what gives us our structure, our framework.
But we must move forward, or the whole blinking thing will grind to a halt.
And we'll be left wandering around in the dark. We'll be lost.
Gentlemen, may I?
Please, please.
Justice Webb calls over a barmaid.
Oh, just a glass of water, please.
She bows and steps away.
The prosecution will soon start focusing on the Philippines. I was witness to the Bataan Death March. Tens of thousands of Filipino and American POWs walked for days under the scorching sun, only to find themselves in dreaded prison camps. In the Battle of Manila, I saw Japanese soldiers killed civilians. I was forced to flee as my own home was burned to the ground.
McDougal rubs his cheek.
This experience remains emotional for me. Thus, I have reached a decision not to sit during the testimony on the Philippines.
But the testimony is about your country. You must help lead the discussion afterwards.
Well, I can help lead the discussion without hearing the testimony. It's a memory I live with every day. I do not want to jeopardize my authority if I'm seen betraying my emotions in court.
You are an honest man, and you have made the right decision, I believe.
Haranelia blinks thoughtfully. Rowling's black sedan sits parked outside Ada's home. Sheets of rain pour down, punctuated by bursts of lightning. In the living room, as Rowling plays, Ada slowly comes into focus at the piano. A flash of lightning spills in through a window. The pianist casts her stern gaze at her partner.
Your phrasing is still wrong. Go again.
Right away?
No, tomorrow. Of course, try it again. Yeah?
After another flash, the lights cut out.
I give up.
As the lamps turn back on, Ada wipes her brow. Outside, with the storm having passed, the musicians amble through the yard. Ata turns to Rowling, who lights her cigarette, then his own. Ata turns away and wanders off. He follows, cigarette case in hand. In the garden, Ata leads him under a tree with low-hanging branches. He ducks his head and follows her to a bench, then glances into the distance. She takes a seat, then he sits beside her.
So, now it's my turn to ask questions.
Bitte?
How did a German woman end up in the middle of the war in Japan?
Ata offers a cool stare.
The translation to your question, am I a Nazi?
Rowling drops his gaze.
Ever heard of Paul Hindemith?
Yes.
He's a brilliant German composer. The Nazis thought his music was decadent, so they fired him from the Academy of Berlin. I protested. Because I was Rhein Irish and famous, the Nazis had a problem. I love Asian music, so the Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda strongly suggested a study trip to Japan. And when the Nazis attacked the Soviet Union in 1941, I was not able to return because I could not take the Trans-Siberian Railway.
Ata turns her gaze to Rowling, who hangs his head.
Sorry. You were very brave, and I was rude to ask.
Well, you must also have experienced such nonsense.
What do you mean?
Well, your country was occupied by the Nazis. I imagine, as a judge, they find ways to make you miserable.
He blinks, lost in thought, then casts his gaze downward.
Personally, I didn't suffer too much compared to others.
In court, a map is displayed, then a slick-haired man testifies.
In December 1946, the prosecution directs its arguments toward actions by the Japanese military in the Philippines. Along with the Battle of Manila, the Bataan Death March was considered a typical example of Japanese military atrocities.
Donald Engel, ages 27, and my permanent address is Laura, Illinois.
In answer to the prosecutor, Engel testifies that even the lack of food could have been stood, and I suppose that going without water could have been taken. But the continued marching for hours in the burning sun was too much. Men were continuously taken out of the column and shot or bayoneted for no reason.
Rowling listens attentively, then composes a letter in his room.
Dear Lise, the trial is well past 6 months now, and it does not look like it will come to an end anytime soon. The views I started with are changing, and so I have decided to present a paper to my colleagues that reflects my opinion. It's all very exhausting. Aside from playing my violin, I have taken to visiting the seaside in order to clear my head. On one of my excursions, I had the good fortune to meet a writer of some renown. His name is Michio Takayama. His latest book is called Harp of Burma. I look forward to meeting him again, as he's considered one of Japan's leading intellectuals. And the trips to the ocean remind me so much of home.
Rowling and a bearded man walk along a beach.
So, how long have you been writing?
Many years. My real profession is the study of German literature.
Ach.
A subtitle. Do you speak German?
Ein bisschen.
A little. I read it better.
I understand. And have you spent time in Germany?
Yes. 3 years.
And were you able to visit my country as well?
No. But I did fall in love with many Dutch painters. Masters of light and color.
You know that Vincent van Gogh was fascinated by Japanese art. He was influenced by the ukiyo-e woodblock prints.
Especially the work of Hiroshige.
Yes. He based two of his paintings on Hiroshige's work. If I had the chance, I would love to see more of his prints.
I will see that image.
That would be very nice.
Later, they sit side by side, as Takayama brushes off his sandal, rolling rubs sand from his bare foot.
Is a trial proceeding as we expected?
The Dutchman puts on his sock and shoe.
Well, in many ways, yes, and in others, no.
As Takayama cleans the sole of his foot, Rowling shoots him a look.
Can I ask you something? What do the Japanese people think of the tribunal?
There are some who have doubts about the trial.
Why do they have doubts?
The militarist should not be tolerated. But some Japanese believe a few of the accused have been made into scapegoats.
He gazes off, blinking. A foamy wave breaks on shore, spilling past the small tower of stacked stones without disturbing it. In chambers, a stack of documents sits on the table.
Justice Rowling has prepared a paper for us. It's entitled, No Legal Basis for the Charge of Crimes of Aggression.
Justice Rowling gazes uneasily as his colleagues each take a copy from the table. McDougal approaches, eyeing the document.
So, you were with us right up until Justice Powell arrived. Now you jump ship.
I assure you that I arrived at this opinion on my own.
Rowling scans the room.
I wrote this paper so that we might properly consider the legal gaps which go as far back as the Pact of Paris right through to our own charter.
Surely we've argued that particular point exhaustively. The Paris Convention is quite clear.
Yes.
Waging aggressive war is illegal.
But there is no agreement in the Pact of Paris that individuals should be held responsible. And if we do not examine this problem in our own deliberations, future legal scholars will question our decisions.
I applaud your concern for scholarship, but future legal minds will always raise questions. It is their responsibility.
Exactly. War is a policy executed by a sovereign state. And if so, then how can we legally determine the level of guilt or punishment for each individual in that state?
We have the charter. It allows us to apply the rule of law.
No, it does not.
Patrick eyes Pal.
It does not. It would be possible if the international community matured to the stage where it has the authority to criminalize aggressive war or punish individuals who wage such a war. But unfortunately, we are not there yet.
People who thought as you do failed to create strong laws after World War I, and now here we are trying to pick up the pieces and prevent future war.
Let me repeat. According to the Pact of Paris, each country can judge for itself whether its action constitutes self-defense or aggression. It was described as a sovereign right.
That interpretation is mistaken. Are you trying to tell us that it allowed the Germans to take whatever they wanted, to murder whomever they chose? That it allowed the Japanese to march into China unchecked?
McDougal gazes sternly.
And now are you trying to tell us it allowed the Japanese to claim it was a war of self-defense? After what they did, you want to let them off the hook?
I admit, it is not an ideal position. It is a harsh reality, given the world as we know it. So we must dismiss the charges.
It's pretty damn hard to ignore a sneak attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's not the point. Nobody wants to ignore Pearl Harbor or all the horrible thing you were talking about, but please, gentlemen, once again, we must be careful not to be moved by a feeling of revenge.
Look,
Rowling weighs his words.
I support the need for war when the rights and borders of independent nations are threatened. And I also believe that war criminals should be severely punished. I first endorsed a charter on political and ethical grounds, and not as an objective jurist. But after more research and a great deal of thought, I now agree with Justice Paul.
With so many victims, you are willing to overlook the crime of waging such a dreadful war.
Rowling prepares to retort.
Ваша страна разделяет ваши взгляды?
The general asks if your views are supported by your country.
No.
Yet.
I don't have to ask my government.
Gazing sternly at Rowling, Zarayanov drops his copy atop the stack.
Я требую отозвать меморандум.
General Zarayanov calls for you to withdraw the memorandum.
I will not. All right, enough of this. Sir William, as president of the tribunal, do you at least agree that the charter is the foundation for this tribunal? And that we are legally and morally bound to honor it?
Yes, of course I do.
Thank you.
Yes?
A uniformed man appears.
Gentlemen, 5 minutes.
Thank you.
As the door closes, Webb faces the others.
But we must allow all opinions to be heard.
Rowling shifts uncomfortably, and Patrick scowls. Later, the Scotsman walks through a park, flanked by MacDougall and Northcroft.
So our focus was on Powell, then Rowling slipped off into the woods.
I can easily see one or two others following him. You know, if we're not careful, we are going to find ourselves outflanked.
The main problem is Webb. In trying to be neutral, he allows too many dissenting points of view to arise.
Patrick wipes his mouth with a handkerchief.
I'm going to offer my resignation.
You can't be serious. The whole tribunal would collapse.
Precisely. Even quicker if all three of us offer our resignations.
Well, with Higgins already gone, three of us go, that'll be quite a scandal. Our government won't go for it.
No, they won't. But they'll do whatever it takes to keep us here.
Well, that's quite a risky bet.
We risk more by doing nothing. When asked what we need to stay on, each of us asked for Webb to be removed.
Now, they'll never remove the president.
They will if it prevents the total collapse of the Tokyo Tribunal. Otherwise, the validity of Nuremberg will be tossed out of the window, too. If all three of us make the same request, we can force the issue.
In the Palace of Westminster, a brown-haired official addresses two gray-haired colleagues.
His precise words are to withdraw the United Kingdom, Canadian, and New Zealand judges.
His listeners share a look.
Judges MacDougall of Canada and Northcroft of New Zealand have also sent resignations to their governments.
MacArthur has to resolve this.
Our man in Tokyo spoke with him already. He showed no interest in mediating between the judges.
A jowly official frowns.
Is Lord Patrick sufficiently aware of the scandal he's about to create? If these three justices abandon their duties, the world will accuse the Commonwealth of sabotaging the trial.
With great respect, Prime Minister, Patrick was an RAF captain during the First War. Despite acute complications with his health, he still went to Tokyo. He doesn't act without forethought, so we would be wise to assume he's determined to leave if he feels it necessary.
The jowly Prime Minister fidgets and faces his gray-haired advisor.
What, then, is our way out?
The letter states the problem is with Justice Powell, the Indian, and Justice Rowling from the Netherlands, but mainly Webb, the presiding judge from Australia.
Let me see it.
The younger man hands the Prime Minister a document. Seated on a sofa, the head of government examines it with eyes narrowed. In the Supreme Commander's office, General MacArthur faces Webb across his desk.
I've asked you here because I'd like a progress report.
Well, the defense have requested a summer recess, but I'm inclined not to grant it. Better we continue to work our way through it.
And no dissension in the ranks?
One or two judges are stubborn in their views, but it's nothing I can't handle.
That is not what I've heard.
From whom?
The United Kingdom's liaison mission to Tokyo, for one. And if what I've heard is correct, you'd best move on it quickly before it festers.
Well, judges are naturally disputatious.
always inclined to debate.
Yes, but towards a common goal, correct?
That's where I'm steering it.
You know, I've led men on missions and into battle in Mexico, Europe, the Philippines, and all across the Pacific. And if I've learned one thing, it's that even with reconnaissance, pre-planning, and the good opinion of the men closest to you, victory always comes down to a will to win. And that will to win has to start at the very top.
Under MacArthur's questioning gaze, President Webb stares with determination. Subtitles appear over Nippon News film footage, the second anniversary of the defeat, praying for peace. In a public square, a crowd stands solemnly with heads bowed. Exactly 2 years after the end of the war, at 11:05 on August 9th in Nagasaki City, where an atomic bomb was dropped, all citizens prayed for peace. Parishioners gather before a statue of a praying saint, and a nun makes the sign of the cross. Girls with veiled heads stand near a pile of rubble outside the bombed-out church. In the courthouse, more subtitles appear. Trial of war criminals reached a climax. The trial of the people who caused this war has continued for a year and 4 months now. Former Minister of Finance Ishibashi took the stand on the 11th. What are the defendants thinking about now? Text appears. August 7th, 1947. Pearl Harbor testimony. Rowling examines photos of the sneak attack.
The prosecution ends its case and the defense team begins its rebuttal. The American lawyer Blakeney tries to establish that key United States officials already foresaw the Japanese attack just before Pearl Harbor. He calls an American Army officer to the stand who had been tasked with decoding a telegram from the Japanese government to its embassy in Washington before Pearl Harbor was bombed. The telegram was an ultimatum to be conveyed to the U.S. government. The witness states that the message was decoded and sent to President Roosevelt. Defense lawyer Blakeney argues that while America did not know that Pearl Harbor would be targeted, it did know that war was imminent. He insists that the attack on Pearl Harbor was therefore not a surprise.
Later, in chambers.
I'm not convinced by Blakeney's argument. America knowing about Japan's intention to launch an attack is not the same as receiving a formal declaration of war.
And even if Roosevelt saw the decoded message, and therefore knew an attack was coming, he still had no idea of when and where exactly it could take place.
Bernard, Haranilia, and May step outside.
In order for them to attack Hawaii by air, the Japanese fleet had to leave Japan more than a week before Pearl Harbor.
But as Blakeney pointed out, the time required between the warning and the commencement of hostilities is not specified in any international law agreement. It means it could be just a minute between the two.
Still a cold-blooded attack.
The trio passes a sentry standing by a closed door. Meanwhile, a soldier guards the Imperial Hotel entrance. Inside, McDougal strides past Webb, who reads a newspaper at a table.
Morning.
Morning.
He joins Patrick and Northcroft.
Morning.
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 Well, my foreign minister got the message loud and clear.
As did mine.
Northcroft gazes toward Webb, whose back is turned.
Do you think he knows?
It isn't my finest maneuver to broadside a decent man, but Webb should go home, whilst we lead this trial to the right conclusion.
Sir Webb, a letter for you.
Thank you.
A bellhop bows to Webb, then departs. Unblinking, President Webb reads the dispatch. Folding it up, he works his jaw and tightens his lips. Later, the Australian enters MacArthur's office.
General.
Sir William, I'm late for a meeting.
Here.
Webb hands him the telegram. MacArthur unfolds it, then peruses it with a raised brow.
They want you back in Australia.
Yes.
To adjudicate an important trial.
Oh, it came completely out of the blue. I've no desire to leave Tokyo.
What the hell's going on? You said everything was just fine.
Well, as Supreme Commander, you could overrule their request.
No, that would create more of a circus. This is already going to feed the papers for months. No. Sir William, you're going to have to keep a lid on this and return to Australia.
He gives the telegram back to Webb.
Very well. Thank you.
Webb nods and heads for the door. The Supreme Commander watches him depart, then thrusts his hands in his pockets. Before reaching the corridor, Webb dons his hat. MacArthur turns away. As the tribunal enjoys refreshments in chambers, the president shuts the door, then makes his way over.
Gentlemen, I apologize for calling you in at such short notice. My government has called me back to Australia. I'm required to take my place at the High Court for an important sitting on the nationalization of Australian banks.
The banks? But the banks are not so important.
I do not have a choice. I'm at the behest of my country. MacArthur will appoint a replacement.
Justice Bernard glances back at Patrick and MacDougall. Wearing his Homburg hat and dark pinstripe suit, Webb strides along a corridor, gazing inscrutably. The Australian carries his briefcase in one hand and his coat draped over his arm. He heads for the double doors, flanked by MPs, at the end of the otherwise vacant corridor. Credits appear. Based on an original idea by NHK Japan Broadcasting Corporation, narrator Stacy Keach. Red letters appear within three brightly tinged eggs, NHK. Logos appear, NEP, NHK, Throne, Serif. Multicolored stripes flank a logo, DCTV, Don Carmody Television, a logo, Fat Productions from Amsterdam to Tokyo, Film Arts Theater Television. This dramatization is inspired by true events. However, certain scenes, characters, names, businesses, incidents, locations, and events have been fictionalized for dramatic purposes. And in those instances, any similarity to actual persons living or dead or to actual entities or events is purely coincidental. This film is protected under the laws of Canada, the United States, Netherlands, Japan, and other countries. Any unauthorized exhibition, distribution, or reproduction of this motion picture or videotape or any part thereof, including the soundtrack, may result in criminal penalties. The production of this episode did not harm any animals. Copyright 2016 Tokyo Productions, Inc., Fat Productions BV, NHK. All rights reserved.